originating from our Jimmy John's of Lexington studios. This is Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network.
But it was all for Chuck McGee. Super Sabre wins the Derby for Todd Fletcher.
Basalt will give trainer Steve Asmussen career win number 6,000.
It was all have another for Doug O'Neill.
Oxbow and D-Wayne Lucas. Trainer D-Wayne Lucas, a sixth win.
And Al's Rosie is going to give trainer Gary Contessa his 2,000th career win.
And Dialed In never got to them. It was Animal Kingdom for Graham Motion.
Steve Hobby with career victory number 1,000 at Oaklawn.
Now here's Mike Pena and Jude Feld.
Hello again, everyone, and welcome to Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton, right here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. This is, of course, the show trainers listen to, and we are happy to have you listening to us over the course of the next hour here tonight. Mike Pena, Baron of the Backstretch, along with retired top trainer Pontiff of the Pick Four, Jude Feld. We are broadcasting from our Jimmy John's of Lexington broadcast studios, and really looking forward to this visit here tonight. Quite often on Trainer Talk, we've had the opportunity to visit with young trainers who are looking to make their mark in the sport of thoroughbred racing, and that is the case here tonight, JT.
Well, this guy's absolutely made his mark. He's a fantastic trainer. He's doing a great job for historic Sagamore Farm, and the farm's been on the upswing ever since Kevin Plank bought it, and he's continuing a recent tradition of success there. So he's got a lot of big shoes to fill, but he's doing a great job.
Well, he is a 32-year-old native of Snyder, Texas. He's trained 35 winners to date, sitting here on July 19, 2017. Those runners have amassed more than $1.5 million in purses, and he spent a little bit of time as an assistant trainer to Ignacio Correas at Kevin Plank's Sagamore Farm before getting the call in 2011 that he would be promoted to head trainer following the departure of Ignacio, who is now operating his own public stable. So let's welcome in Horacio DePaz to Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton. Horacio, thanks for taking a little time.
Yes, thank you for having me.
Yeah, happy to have you with us. Talk about getting that call from Ignacio that, hey, you know what? I'd like you to come join me over here at historic Sagamore. That had to be special.
Yeah, it definitely was because, you know, obviously the history of Sagamore Farm, you know, it's pretty rich and, it's a very big place as far as history and horse racing goes. So coming out here and also being able to work underneath him and train racehorses off of a farm, it's also a unique setting. Most of the time in the United States, obviously, you train at a racetrack, and it really drew me to this place because, you know, we were going to do some breaking, developing young horses and then training them to be racehorses here, and also encompassing going to the racetrack and having horses there. So you kind of got a little bit of everything. And also the tranquility of being out on the farm, it's just so much peaceful than, you know, the everyday hustle and bustle of the racetrack. So that really drew me to this facility.
Was it kind of relaxing for you because you worked for Todd for a while and in Florida, off track stabling and that kind of stuff where you can kind of do your own thing?
Yeah, I mean, obviously, yeah, I worked for Todd. You know, I was based at Churchill and went to California with their string out there. So you got the hustle and bustle and obviously that organization, the way that they do things and just the huge amount of people and horses that they manage. And then, you know, then you encompass the farm, which is totally opposite, which is quieter. You could take your time with horses and, you know, you can do what you want to do as far as training. You know, you don't have no training hours or the track's not closed or, you know, you can go out in the field and gallop. So I really wanted to learn more of that as well, to just have an arsenal of tools that, you know, you could do different things with horses.
You know, that's pretty remarkable. You mentioned Horacio working with Todd, and normally at this point you would come back and say, of course, we're talking about Todd Pletcher, but he's one of those guys in the world of sports, Jude, that Todd Pletcher has now earned the right to be known as Todd. He's like Oprah, for example. You say the name. You know, very few people in the world of sports and media can be known by one name. Well, you say Todd in Thoroughbred Racing, and now you know.
Yeah, you're not talking about Shrupp.
How good is Todd Pletcher, Horatio?
Oh, he's remarkable. I mean, he's just, you know, he's at the top of the game for a reason. I loved working for him, learned a lot from him, you know, and he's developed some people that have left his operation as well. So he's just a really good guy. So, you know, when it comes down to it, you know, amongst everything that he does, you know, he's just a very good guy. So very privileged there.
Talk about some of the things that you learned being around Todd Pletcher.
You know, he deals with a lot of high profile owners, expensive horses, amongst, you know, all the personalities that you have as far as running an operation like that with employees. I think just everything all around, just how he handles everything on a day-to-day basis is just, you know, it's really impressive and something that you take into account, because, you know, there's something going on every day with, you know, either a horse or employees or owners. So just the way that he manages all that is, that's kind of more of the impressive part of what I took from him. And then amongst, yeah, he's a good horseman as well too. He can make decisions, but based on information that he gets. So that's you know, to another level of where he can kind of place his horses and where to send them, you know, and things like that. The communication that he has with his employees.
Did you spend a lot of time observing him as he was going through his daily activities, like really focusing in on him?
Yeah, the only time that I really got to see him, you know, because we were based in Kentucky, you know, he'd come in for the Derby or for Breeders' Cup, and they would usually come in for a month or come in for a few weeks. So on a day-to-day basis, you know, you got to see how he handled his operation from being away, but then you also saw how he did things when he was in town. So, but yeah, you definitely try to observe as much as you can of how he does things. So,
the reason I asked that question was I can hear a lot of Todd in the way that you're talking with us, your vocabulary and your your attention to detail when you're giving us your answers. It's very, very Todd like. So it's cool that you were able to pick that up.
Yeah, well, he's from Texas, so that's where I'm from. So maybe it just kind of
maybe it's a Texas thing.
Off like that.
Yeah, that's cool.
Was there a certain kinship there, Horatio, with both of you being from Texas? Did that help in developing that relationship at all?
I'm not sure. You know, his father, actually, he grew up for a little time where I was from, so I kind of built up a little bit of a relationship with his father because of that and some people that they know that I knew, because I also went to go work for his father in between working for Todd, you know, working on the farm, breaking babies and doing things like that. So, you know, kind of became close to his father for that reason, you know, just kind of being associated with people that they knew from back home. So, but I wouldn't say that just, you know, because we're from Texas that, you know, you kind of bonded a little bit more, you know, it's just more of a professional type bond or whatever from work.
What are the contrasts between working for JJ Pletcher and Todd? Do they do everything the same or are there some differences?
JJ's more laid back and he's kind of like, you know, just enjoying life and, you know, things happen and you just kind of go on. And Todd's very structural, and I would say, you know, obviously he's very businessy and he's, you know, very attentive to everything that he does. His dad's really funny though, he's, you know, but he's at that stage, you know, where he can enjoy life and stuff. And, you know, Todd's kind of always in the hustle and bustle of what he's got going on. So I think JJ's the one that would, as you would say, blow the turn or get in trouble before Todd would do it.
Horatio DePaz, our special guest here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton. Horatio, I'll put you on the spot a little bit with this next one. Do you have a favorite JJ Pletcher or Todd Pletcher story that you like to tell when people ask you about your time and working with them?
I'm not sure if I would have a favorite. I mean, I've spent good times with both guys. You know, JJ just kind of, he kind of taught me the ropes as far as, you know, basically, when I went to go work for him, it would be like, how do you manage an expensive horse as far as breaking them and doing things? Growing up in Texas, you know, it could get a little cowboy and stuff like that. But just to kind of handle that type of mindset of how they did things as far as handling the client's horse that's to that level. But like with Todd, you know, I mean, we had good times and stuff, but I think you kind of see a little bit more of how to handle difficult situations, as far as, you know, incidents that happen with horses and stuff like that. I couldn't put one story above the other with those two guys.
All right, let's talk about handling a good horse then. What is the proper way? How do you handle a horse of that caliber when they come into your stable?
Well, as far as like with JJ and them, as far as breaking, obviously you want to do the process the easiest that you can for the horse to obviously, you know, accept what he's going to start learning as far as having a rider on his back and stuff like that without having to get that horse hurt. So it's, you know, it's a slow process. It's a gentle process as best as you can. And then at some point, too, you just got to forget about the price tag and just kind of work by your feel and try to do what's best for the horse without trying to, you know, have things get too rough. And obviously you're dealing with animals that are creatures and they have their own minds, so you got to try to set them up for success. And kind of reading them is the biggest key. I mean, obviously, if you read a horse and he don't look like he want to be rode, he'll make you pay for it real quick. And that ground gets pretty hard when you hit it. So you kind of got to, you know, use your best judgment, which I think that's something that's developed by working with young horses and watching their characteristics, obviously in the round pen and stuff like that, that whenever you start working them with race horses, you kind of read things that, you know, maybe he's not ready to handle some pressure, or you give them a little bit of pressure and they start handling more and more, and then they kind of thrive off the pressure. So it kind of teaches you to back off, and then it teaches you kind of how to press on. So it's, I enjoy it. I love breaking horses. You know, it always keeps you thinking, and when you think that you have it and you got it right, and you end up on the ground and you're like, well, I guess I don't know as much as I thought I knew. So, but it's an interesting, you know, it's an interesting thing to do with that. And obviously developing young two-year-olds is the same way, just in a different sense as far as developing them into racehorses. So, you know, when you start seeing that the light bulb starts to click off, and then you kind of, you know, you kind of see they're feeding off of your training and what they're doing and what they're handling. And then, you know, and then they go on and race and they are able to perform well, then you're like, wow, you know, you saw it kind of coming little by little, in small increments, and it's a good feeling. But then again, we've also had some, you know, obviously you train them and they show everything, and then you run them and you're like, what? And you kind of sit back and you're like, they humble you too. So it's an interesting game.
You know, you mentioned that you have to somehow forget about the price tag, and that can be difficult to do, I would imagine. Is it?
It is. It is. You know, I've really kind of just, you know, once they're bought at a sale and once they, you know, come to you and stuff, you know, they're a horse. They're just a horse. You know, you got to work according to what they need done. But, yeah, sometimes if you do think about it, you know, like, well, this horse bought for $1 million or whatever, and you're like, well, you start kind of tippy-toeing around them. And, you know, that's, even though it's $1 million or, you know, a $10,000 horse, you start tippy-toeing around them and they feel that, and then it just sets up. It doesn't set them up to be confident. So, but you do worry about it, because then you don't want it to get hurt, and you don't want it, you know, obviously you don't want to ruin somebody's horse, but try to stay, you know, as far away as thinking like that as best as we can.
You talked about conceptualizing horses and having a clue as to what they might like to do or what they might be based on watching them in the round pen and that type of thing. Talk about that a little bit. The great California trainer Daryl Viena, he always used to say that, you know, you need to have some idea of where a young horse is going, and based on pedigree or whatever. But talk about conceptualizing a horse and the positives and negatives of that.
Yeah, I mean, there's some horses that first-time experience, they might handle a little bit easier than others, and there's some horses that you notice kind of in a round pen that anything that's first-time experience, they kind of blow up on you a little bit. And that's a unique thing here about the farm, is that we don't do our breaking here, because we just accumulated much more horses than we can handle to put that process in. So when we did do it, though, when you had offsprings from mares that, you know, they had the same personalities, and they literally did like the same things in the round pen as, you know, like when you first did initial things with them, they just kind of carried on. So you knew what to expect from them. And then when you know the families and they go off and they run, kind of see some similarities in them as well. But it is a huge advantage when you know your young horses, because then when they get to the racetrack, you know what you can do with them. Right now, the way that we process things here is, we send our horses to Ocala Stud, and you know, they've done a really good job, and they do have a very good operation of what they do, and we have good feedback. You know, I talk to them about how they're coming along, the two-year-old or the yearlings and the two-year-old, and we go out there and watch them train, and so there's a lot of feedback that they give me. That way, when they come in, even though I'm not in the round pen with them and doing that breaking anymore, we're very up to date on personalities and what they think of the horses. So it's a really good team effort that we have in a relationship too.
I was going to ask you about that, Horatio. As a former exercise rider, how much are you relying, now that you're the head trainer, how much are you relying on the feedback you're getting from the individuals that are above those aboard those horses every morning? How much is there a give and take there with that interaction?
Yeah, there's a ton. You know, I rely a lot on my riders. You know, I'm still having in that process of growing, learning how to delegate. I still get on a lot of horses. I like to breeze a lot of my horses, and now it's becoming challenging when you're in different locations of trying to accommodate that stuff. Maybe sometimes I spread myself out a little bit too thin. But, you know, through the process, obviously, like when they, you talk to an exercise rider or one of my writers and stuff, when they give me feedback, I really kind of can understand what they're saying just from being in the same similar experiences that they might be in as well, and knowing the horses. And usually I like to get on all of our horses, you know, once a week at least, because you notice little changes. And when you get on them all the time, you might get adjusted to them of how they're going. And when you don't, you get on them, you kind of feel odd end things about them that maybe need changes. And you know, there's a big thing about equipment, just communication with everybody in general. I really like to get a lot of feedback from everybody.
I always thought it was a huge edge if a trainer could get on their own horses. I never had that opportunity at nearly 300 pounds. So
Poor horse.
Plus, yeah, I like horses too much to get on. And the last horse I was on was in Jamaica about 20 years ago. But and he was 17 hands. He could haul me around Jamaica. He was cool. But yeah, I mean, that's got to really give you a lot of confidence when you take a horse over to the races that you know him so well and what he's capable of.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, there are horses that there's little tiny things that you can do on top of them to either get them to shut down or you kind of can find a rider as far as a jog, the set of hands that horse might need, especially working horses and kind of noticing where their fitness is at. And then working for Todd for so long and getting on some horses that he had, you know, you definitely know how a nice horse goes versus a horse that is probably a level or two below that. And then again, you also have a horse that's maybe at a low level, but he's just doing really good and just kind of hitting the ground really good and just has a confidence about him that you maybe could take a shot at a little bit higher, you know, type of race or allowance or something like that. I mean, I really rely on it. I don't know what I'll do whenever, you know, I start eating more and I'm not able to get on horses and breeze horses, but hopefully, you know, we get that figured out as far as getting comfortable as far as watching horses. That's also a unique trait too, because there's trainers that they got a very good eye at watching a horse to know when a horse is doing good as well. So you know, and there's a lot of trainers that, you know, they developed a good eye for that kind of stuff as well.
Well, speaking of being aboard very good horses, for a guy like Todd Pletcher, you had the privilege of being aboard Champion Uncle Mo in the weeks leading up to his Breeders' Cup Juvenile victory at Churchill Downs. Tell me a little bit about being aboard Uncle Mo. That had to be pretty cool.
Yeah, it was cool. I wasn't his regular exercise rider at the time. You know, he came in probably 2 weeks before the Breeders' Cup, so I was just hanging on for dear life with that horse because he was very forward and he knew what he was coming to do. But he was a nice racehorse. So I got to breeze him the week before, and I mean, he's just beautiful. I mean, it was one of those rides where you just kind of sit there and you just kind of like, wow, just very automatic. His mind was right. He was very confident. You know, he just, everything about him, he had a presence about him that, you know, he was going to take a very nice horse to beat him during that time. So, very nice.
How long does it take you to know that you're aboard a very special horse when you get on these young horses?
I would say usually, you know, when you start breezing them, you start seeing some tendencies about them that, you know, that they're doing. And then the way that they're eating, and then obviously if you're able to kind of press on them a little bit, kind of train them a little bit harder leading up to something, and how they accept it, then you know what kind of confidence they have and how much they can take. And, you know, not saying that you can't train some horses you might not be able to train hard, and they can still run and be very nice horses. There's a lot of horses that you breeze in the morning, and they seem like they're pretty nice horses, and then in the afternoon they just don't show it. So, but I would say mostly when you're starting to breeze, once you start going those 5/8, you start galloping out pretty strong, and I like to kind of, once they get to a level of fitness when they can handle some more serious works, when you match them up with an older horse, and they're trying to be competitive with them, then you kind of, you know how far they kind of want to try to compete and stuff like that.
Did you always have training in the back of your mind when you were an exercise rider?
When I joined the racetrack, I did. Before I came to the racetrack, I was in Texas and did some quarter horse match races out there. I was riding quarter horses and stuff and enjoyed that. And then got out of school, did some, junior college and stuff, and thought about being a vet. And then I was just very attracted to the care of the horses and kind of preparing them for races and doing that kind of stuff. So then when I joined the racetrack, it was always, I kind of set myself up to try to, at a certain time, try to be at a point wherever active I wanted to train or be capable of training, that I would be able to do it. I also obviously went to try to find the best people that I could work for. And when I found Todd and I stayed with him for a while, when I went to go work for him, it was at after Churchill in 2006. He had 18 horses running in the Breeders' Cup. I was like, oh, that guy must know what he's doing. So I went with him to California, and that's the first year that he went out there to California, and then I stayed with him for, 4.5 years.
Horatio, I read somewhere that you were attracted, one of the things that attracted you to Sagamore was the close-knit atmosphere of that organization. Tell me a little bit about Sagamore and how they operate.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, I was attracted, because of the farm and just the history of the farm and what they were trying to build out here at the farm. They have the close-knitness is that they have the brood mares here. You see the mares drop their foals. You have the weanlings, yearlings, and you see them develop. And then earlier on, we had the yearlings that used to come over to us. We do the breaking process. And then you just have that cycle of the brood mares and the yearlings and stuff. So that was something that attracted to me a lot, because just the development of horses, obviously and then they also went out to the sales and they would buy horses to try to, obviously you're always trying to upgrade your broodmare band or your race horses, so that's kind of more of the attraction here.
Yeah, I love that you referenced the history of the farm, and I can only imagine as a young man you walk through those doors at Sagamore, that had to be a powerful experience as a horse racing fan. Talk a little bit about that day that you first walked in.
Oh yeah, I came here to visit, before I came out. It's just, what they've done to the place since Kevin took over, has just been remarkable. And you do feel the history when you come through here. Amongst the other things, like Pimlico is 20 minutes away from us, and I like going to Pimlico. You go out there first set early in the morning and you just kind of gallop around that racetrack, a little spooky, because you're like, all the great horses that have been over that racetrack, it's just, it's pretty amazing. And I like the history of the horse racing and everything that comes along with that. So working for a place, there's not a lot of places where you're going to find, obviously Lexington and Kentucky, but as far as like, something like Sagamore, it's not, they get developed or they get sold as golf courses, and the land's not there anymore, so that's I really like that they're trying to save this little bit of history for horses.
It's one of the most beautiful areas for horses in the United States, I think. I really enjoy spending time in Maryland horse country. I think it's just gorgeous.
Yeah, it definitely is. You've got there's a lot of history. They have, Bell or Stud, Man of War, and War Admiral, all those horses. I mean, they used to race some really, really nice racehorses out here. You have a lot of fox hunting out here. Just, horse country. It really is.
Kevin Plank, of course, the owner of Sagamore and the founder of Under Armour, a former football player. Look, Horatio, he's a very competitive guy, doesn't like to lose, and that's why he's been so successful. What's that like working for somebody that's so competitive, somebody in your position? What's that like?
Well, it's nice because we were all driven to, you know, obviously we all want to win and we all have that competitiveness in us. I think initially I think it's a learning curve of, you know, you lose more than you win, but it's still nice because you're pushed to try to do the best that you can do. So you know, you use it as inspiration, you know, to move forward and try to place your horses in the correct spots to try to compete and showcase them as best as you can.
How much Under Armour apparel is in your closet?
We got a lot. Yeah, we got a lot of that. It's good stuff to wear.
That's kind of a loaded question, isn't it?
Yeah.
Well, I figured it would be plenty of.
I would get in trouble if I didn't have a lot of that apparel in my closet. Right.
If he said, "No, I just wear Nike."
Yeah.
No, that's a no-no.
That's a bad word around those parts.
Yeah.
Horatio DePaz with us here on Trainer Talk, presented by Phasic Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Don't forget, if you miss any portion of this show on SiriusXM or streaming on our website, you can head over and check out the podcast. HorseRacingRadio.net is where you can listen to the podcast of this show and all of our Trainer Talk shows. Also, Horse Racing Radio Network on iTunes. So, Horatio, how would you describe your approach to training racehorses?
Patience. Really, obviously looking, I don't really try to rush too much. I really focus on, you know, every horse's needs. Like right now, you know, we really have a very unique opportunity because we can train horses at the racetrack at Laurel, and there's horses that do well there. And we also have the farm, in which we have a lot of horses that do very well here. So try to place them wherever they're going to be the happiest. And, you know, obviously do your training and switch it up. I really wouldn't have a set approach because there's horses that do things completely different than other horses. I mean, I have horses that live in a paddock all day because they won't eat, and they train off the farm, and then they just sit to the racetrack and they run, and they've been very consistent and very good at that. And I've got horses, you know, I take them to the racetrack, and I notice that they just, it's almost if they're on the farm, they lollygag because there's not much activity going on. So when they go to the race, when they're at the racetrack, it's more like they need to be around that type of an atmosphere to continue to focus and get the best out of their workouts in the morning. So I'm very fortunate to be able to have both opportunities to train in two different facilities that are just like, you know, 45 minutes apart. And I'm very comfortable with training on the farm or training like out in the field and stuff. You know, when I learned to gallop out in the open cotton field, so, you know, didn't need a racetrack, so you can kind of get some fitness into a horse by, you know, just getting them into a nice gallop, you know, in a nice field and stuff like that. So, but yeah, and mostly it's patience, just waiting for the horse to tell you that he's ready to run, and not trying to rush him and put him somewhere where he's not going to be able to be successful.
Well, he's come a long way from galloping horses in those open cotton fields of Texas. We're going to hear more from Horatio DePaz when we come back. Second half of Trainer Talk is next. Stay with us on the Horse Racing Radio Network.
Selected sales, superior results. The July sale, ranked among the top yearling sales in North America. 300 yearlings catalog. Starting with Champion Silver Bullet Day, Hall of Famer Bob Baffert has trained 8 Grade 1 winners that were sold at Phasic Tipton July.
Where were you being July?
The July sale and July selected horses of racing age sale. July 10th and 11th at Phasic Tipton in Lexington. Where will you be?
I know where I'll be. I'll be at Phasic Tipton July sale.
Bloom Racing.
Majestic City could also still do it, and here he comes.
Majestic City running a big one.
Started by former jockey and 35-year racing industry veteran Jeffrey Bloom, Bloom Racing offers racing partnerships, bloodstock services, pin hooking, and private race management.
Soul Driver the leader, though. Soul Driver in front.
Experience the fun, excitement, and exclusive access of racehorse ownership with Bloom Racing. Forming racing partnerships now. Get in on the action at bloomracing.com.
Kentucky Downs kicks off a unique five-day all-grass race meet in September. Live racing September 3rd, 8th, 10th, 11th, and 15th. And the stakes are high with $7.8 million in purses over the 5 days, an average of $1.56 million each day. Kentucky Breds will run for maiden special weight purses of $130,000 and allowance purses of $145,000. Maidens not bred in Kentucky will compete for $58,000 with top allowance for non-Kentucky Breds at $67,000. Learn more at KentuckyDowns.com.
It all started with a dream. A dream to be the best. To breed the best. To race the best.
Super Saver Ross Amayan, what a finish to the class.
And to stand the best. Windstar Farm, dedicated to the dream.
Now is the perfect time to own a Kentucky Bred and race in Kentucky. Kentucky Breds win 70% of the greatest stakes in North America, and it's obvious that Kentucky Breds start with a clear advantage. But there's more. Over $8 million in additional purse money is available at the five Kentucky tracks for horses eligible for the Kentucky Thoroughbred Development Fund. Kentucky is a good place to race your Kentucky Bred. Come home to Kentucky and make a start. Learn more at KentuckyBred.org.
This is Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network.
Lipstick City, Danceland has to angle very wide, seven lengths off the lead. Valentine Wish is in behind horses. Here's Sweeping Patty coming forward to challenge and get the lead from Folk Magic. Chubby Star dives down to the inside, finds an opening there, and Danceland is still fourth, far outside. Chubby Star up the inside to put ahead in front from Sweeping Patty. Folk Magic in third. Chubby Star with a narrow lead from Sweeping Patty. Chubby Star and Jose Ortiz to win it. Sweeping Patty second, Folk Magic third. Savannah Bell was fourth.
And welcome back to Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Kurt Becker with the call. Chubby Star getting the victory at Keeneland. That was this past April, April 7th to be exact. Chubby Star, the first Keeneland winner, trained by our special guest here on Trainer Talk tonight. That is Horatio DePaz, and we'll continue this visit with Horatio here momentarily. Mike Pennejude-Feld in our Jimmy Johns of Lexington broadcast studios. JT, this weekend, another special weekend for us here on the network. We kick off our Saturdays at Saratoga broadcast series, which is all presented by our friends at visitbarbados.org. And for those who have not heard yet, we will be at Saratoga every single Saturday here on the network to bring you exclusive radio coverage of all those major stakes races. Seven consecutive Saturdays. Should be amazing.
Yeah, well, the Saratoga meet is always very special, and the big races usually occur on Saturday, so it's going to be a lot of fun to be there for those races and bring them to the fans, and looking forward to a fantastic meet.
And you can see a complete Saturdays at Saratoga schedule on our website, horseracingradio.net. So head on over, check out the SiriusXM channel information, and listen to us worldwide on our website with streaming of all of those races, horseracingradio.net. All right, well, Chubby Star, that victory April 7th at Keeneland. Horatio, that had to be a very special moment for you to walk into that Keeneland winner's circle.
Oh, yes, definitely was, especially with a filly like her.
Yeah, what makes her so special?
Well, she's one, like I said, here with the program that we have. She was born and raised on the farm. We started her initial breaking with her, and she went down to Bucala Stud, and she grouped up with us on her two-year-old year, and, you know, she's just been a very forward, competitive filly since she came back to us as a two-year-old. So, you know, going to Keeneland is a touch, you know, it's a very prestigious place there to go there and be able to win a race there with the Maryland homebred. It was nice just for the Sagamore name and the operation that we have.
Yeah, there's something special about winning a race at Keeneland. It's very important to the people that live here in Lexington and race horses. No matter what the level, it doesn't need to be a stakes race or anything else. Just to win a race at Keeneland puts a smile on the owner's face, and it was great to see, you know, Sagamore have that win at Keeneland.
Yes, definitely. And you talk about the owner. The owner's daughter actually named that filly, which made it even that much more special because the daughter's so in tune to what that filly does. So that's good that they are so a part of it personally. And usually, you have owners that name horses after family members or certain things, and they don't always kind of come together like that. So it was nice to see that, the happiness in that little girl, that filly that she named, as a win picture. I don't know if she knows the significance of Keeneland, but, for everybody else, it's just a good story.
So what is Chubby Star then?
So Chubby Star, it was originally a wristband that his daughter gave to Kevin, and he would wear it around, and he wore it around on his wrist a lot. And then so eventually, it wore down. So one day his daughter said, oh, it looks more like a Chubby Star instead of a star. And with the filly being out of Salsa Star, the name just kind of, came together for that.
Well, pretty special and a great moment. And that's what horse racing is all about, no doubt about it. All right, Horatio, mm-hmm. So a kid growing up in Snyder, Texas, you somehow become interested in thoroughbred racing. Now, if people aren't familiar with Snyder, Texas, I want you to tell us a little bit more about the town. But when I looked it up on Wikipedia, it said that there are only, 11,000 people in Snyder, Texas?
Yeah, it's grown since I've left. It's actually smaller when I was there. It's like 9,000.
You were keeping them away, huh?
I know. I thought I was, thought I was keeping it up, and I left, and everybody moved there.
What's Snyder, Texas, all about?
West Texas. It's obviously it's a very small town. A lot of cotton, a lot of oil. The majority of my family out there, they work in the oil field. Most people, very small school. So it's just a very small upbringing compared to the city, where I'm very slow. It's, I like it. It's home for me. I'm very proud, obviously, to be a Texan. I kind of maybe say that a little bit too much. But great place to be raised, great family there, great memories and stuff. So,
you can't say it enough if you're a Texan, and if you're not a Texan, you think you're probably saying it too much.
Yeah.
Here's another neat little fact about Snyder, Texas. It actually named for it. Now, assuming this is true, named for the merchant and buffalo hunter William Henry Snyder, who went by Pete. It was built as he built the trading post on Deep Creek in 1878. Jude was his first customer, as a matter of fact.
Yeah. I remember old Pete.
Yeah, the white buffalo. I think they shot a white buffalo there.
Wow.
So how do you then become interested in horse racing growing up in such a remote town?
Well, I've always just been interested in horses in general. That's kind of been something that's attracted me since I was young. We weren't fortunate enough, obviously, during that time when I was young to have a horse or anything like that. And then my dad started later in life. He accumulated a few quarter horses, and then he started match racing quarter horses. And once I went to that, to a match race, I watched two horses coming down the lane, kind of a nose-to-nose type race. And I was like, wow, the adrenaline was just, awesome. So I'm like, starting to get involved with that, started riding horses. We would go around different cities, different weekends, and ride other people's horses, ride my dad's horses, and then obviously make some money, obviously got attracted to betting on the horses, obviously it's not a parimutuel track or nothing. You just kind of go up to a person and ask them, who do you like? Because you like, yeah, sure. It's just the raw passion about it, about the match races, that people that go there, they just enjoy the horse racing. And even today, it's you got some guys that came up from Louisiana that grew up, some nice jocks and stuff. They came up riding in match races like that. And it's the family atmosphere and everything that happens. It just, that's what attracted me to the racetrack. And then, just as time went on and knowing people kind of set me up to go into Lone Star, and then went to meet some people there. Then I first went to my actual racetrack was Louisiana Downs. So you can imagine living in the town, population 9,000 at the time, and going and working in Louisiana Downs and staying on the backside, that was a real awakening for me, because I was always used to a small, quiet place, and that place was loud at the time. But I met great people there, and it was a great experience. And, you know, just one thing, I've always had to drive to kind of move forward and just try to better myself every year, and, you know, work with as many people as I could that were, that you would notice that you liked what they were doing. And, just everything just kind of took me to a different place. Went to Arkansas, Kentucky, and then Kentucky, California. Got to travel and meet people all over the place. I met some good friends out in California. Guy that trains quarter horses, rented me a room to live with, and he's an outrider out there. Learned a lot from him. Still talk to him, at least monthly and stuff. Talk about horses, and and now I'm fortunate to kind of have my own little thing going on. So it's been good.
How much different is it being on the back of a quarter horse as opposed to a thoroughbred?
Well, thoroughbreds definitely, they're a little bit leaner type of horse. You have to have them a little bit, the fitness has to be able to go past a mile and stuff like that. Or even your sprinters, the fitness is, the training is completely different from quarter horses. Quarter horses, you just feel a lot of red powder underneath you all the time. They're a little short, stocky. I still miss doing the quarter horses because it's just, I like the power that they have. But thoroughbreds, obviously, you still get a feeling of what they do too. They're both very nice creatures to work with.
Who's Chelsea?
That's my wife.
Ah, she's your biggest fan. She was the first one to retweet your appearance on Trainer Talk tonight.
Oh wow, putting me out there. She does my social media for me since I don't really do it.
Yeah, you were telling us earlier off air that you're not really a big social media guy, and that's ironic coming from a young kid like yourself.
Well, he's hardly a kid.
Well, he's 32 years old. To me, well, he's a kid, and he's really a kid.
Yeah, absolutely, because I remember old Pete.
No, I keep my time. I'm more of a, obviously, I don't tweet a lot, or, I have a Facebook, get on there and see what's going on, keep up with family and stuff, but not very active with pictures and, just odd things that I might be thinking throughout the day, just kind of can't get myself to kind of doing it.
Did you meet Chelsea on the racetrack?
Yes, I did. She actually, she was working out in California. She was an exercise rider at the time for Jeff Mullins out there.
So you had something in common right off the bat. That always helps.
Yes, yeah. She worked with the industry out there, and she's from Washington, so state of Washington. So, and she's a huge, has a lot of passion for horses, in general too.
It's important to have a wife that understands the game and the fact that you're not going to be at the picnic on Saturday or mowing the lawn or whatever. Has that helped you that she has that horse knowledge and knowledge of the game?
Oh, yes, tremendously. She understands it's obviously the grind of 7 days a week and, the ups and downs, traveling, being here and there. We have a two-year-old daughter now, so the traveling is getting a little bit trickier. Obviously, you have to prepare things, babysitters, and everything in general as far as that goes is having the family. But it is a huge help that she knows the industry and how things work. So she's been, great support for me as well.
Would you ever give her a leg up on one of those horses today?
Definitely. She's a very good rider. She has a good seat on a horse, and she's I don't know if after we've had her daughter, if she's as brave as she was before. She competed 3-day eventing, stuff that I would have never done, and she actually took me out in Lexington one day, and they call it going on a hack, and this horse, he was running off with me underneath the trees, and I'd rode horses and stuff. This horse, he felt every little movement that I made, and he was not liking me. But she's got a well background education as far as proper riding, dressage, jumping, and obviously that cross country stuff. It's not for the weak hearted, because that's a tough sport. Definitely a tough sport. So, definitely I would give her a leg up anytime.
Yeah, for people who don't know about 3-day eventing, it's like a triathlon for horses, and it's beautiful to watch, and it's a very difficult sport to be involved with, because there's so many little facets of horsemanship involved.
Yeah, definitely a big bond with your horse. They create huge relationships.
talking with Horatio DePaz here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasic Tipton, the private trainer for historic Sagamore Farm, and a guy who has had an awful lot of success in a very short period of time and really making his mark on thoroughbred racing. Horatio, earlier we talked about getting your start working with a guy like Todd Pletcher and his father, JJ. So I think it's unfair to ask you who's the best trainer that you've ever been around, but did you grow up watching other trainers, and was there another trainer maybe that you somewhat looked up to or idolized?
Growing up, it was just obviously doing quarter horses and stuff like that. I mean, people just kind of did. There's a lot of people that didn't know what they were doing, and then there were some people that did know what they were doing, but not like a specific person. You know, when I got to the racetrack, there was definitely people that I took notice of that were doing things well and ran a good operation. You know, obviously it's hard not to focus in on those trainers that are at the top, whether it's a Billy Mott, Steve Asmussen, you know, just observe and see how they do things, you know, from a far away. You know, and some of the old trainers too, just stories that you might find from people that you talk to that have been in the game for a long time. So, you know, just, I guess you would say I just kind of take a little bit of what I kind of saw from the outside from different people.
What's the most difficult lesson that you've had to learn?
Delegating.
How so?
That would be like me not trying to do all the work in the barn. you know, I think that's kind of a learning curve for myself anyways. That's because being like when I was working for Todd, you were a foreman and you were involved in a lot of things. You helped out to do a lot of things, horses and stuff like that. Oh. Something just put. You help out doing everything. So when you start doing your own thing, you're doing more about talking on the phone and, you know, dealing with the owners and talking to them about the horses. And you have people that are, you know, doing the work and stuff like that. So I think for myself, that was kind of taking a step back and just relying on people to kind of use their skills to doing something.
I think a lot of that comes with time and trust. You know, once you have your stable for a while and you have a certain person that you know that you can depend on, that they're going to be like you and do things the way that you would do them, then you can kind of take a deep breath and say, wow, that's great. I have somebody to lean on now. And it does take a while because, you know, when you start out, you're pretty much on your own doing your, you know, one or two horse stable thing, and you kind of went into a different atmosphere in that you're taking over a large amount of horses and responsibility all at once. So you got a good grasp. You're gonna find that person sooner or later.
Yeah, now I got a good group of people that we've assembled that work for us, and you know, they're helping out a lot, and a lot of the stuff that we've done is because of the people that have been, you know, helping us out do the day-to-day stuff.
You know, we mentioned at the top of the show that it was Ignacio Correas who made the phone call to you and said, hey, what do you think of coming to work with me at Sagamore? And then when Ignacio went out on his own, you ended up taking over that operation. How closely do you follow the career of Ignacio Correas now?
Yeah, I noticed his horses that are running and stuff. He's, you know, a good horseman, and he's going to do well. Very nice guy and things like that. His background goes very deep, family history, you know, Argentina and stuff, and that country's very involved in horse racing. So you got to learn a lot from the stories that he would talk about, things that would go on back home and where he'd been, and, you know, he spent time in France. I think that's one of the things I wish that I would have done is gone to Europe, maybe worked in France or in England, just to kind of, because it's a whole other world, and the way that they do things is just completely different. So it would have been another asset too, as far as, you know, when you go out on your own or you're doing something on your own, that it's another tool that you can use according to the way that they do things. So I learned a lot from him as well.
He is a master storyteller. There's no question about the first night that I met him, we were at dinner in Lexington and I was just enthralled, and I couldn't believe it. I had more fun than I'd had in the last 15 years. That was about five years ago, and we've been good friends ever since. He's an amazing guy, and he's really on quite a roll right now.
Yeah, he's done very well. He's picked up some horses from South America, and he's doing very well. Built up a stable, and he keeps at it.
Horatio, how cool is it for you now to walk into the paddock with one of your own Sagamore horses that you are training, and you look over, and there's a guy like Todd Pletcher, for example, who you learned from, and you're going head-to-head with him, and sometimes maybe you even beat him in those races. How cool is that?
It's nice. I mean, it's obviously, you have a relationship there, and, hopefully we go there with the right horse, because we know he's going there with the right horse. And, but, the atmosphere, that is pretty surreal, and it's not really nerve-wracking for me, just because I spent time around them and stuff, and knowing that we put our time in to try to obviously go up there to compete with people like that, that we hopefully represent ourselves in the right way.
What does your family think of racing?
Well, Mom's still asking if I'm going to go back to school and get a degree. My dad's thrilled; he loves it. He wants to retire and come help out and work over here. So, but they're happy. Obviously, when my mom visited me when I was at Louisiana Downs, and she couldn't believe that that's what I was doing. And she went to my dad and she said, "You're the one that got him involved in this. I don't know why you did this to him." But, it was obviously hard for her to see that. Because none of my family, I don't have any family members that worked on the racetrack or anything like that. So it was very new for everybody. And obviously those 7 days a week and not being, obviously not going home for the holidays or family reunions, it's been a little tough on the family and stuff, but kind of just committed myself to kind of doing the best that I can do at this and taking advantage of opportunities. But I think my mom's coming around. She watches the races and she's getting, involved in what's going on and things like that. So there, and my parents, both my parents, they've been very supportive in everything that I've done. As far as, when I was growing up. So they're good people.
You probably don't know this, but your mom goes to parties and she's going to be telling everybody, my son's got horses at Saratoga. She won't let on to you, but that's how my mom was. She hated the fact that I was a horse trainer, but I overheard her one day saying, "Well, Jude won a stakes at Santa Anita the other day." And I go, "Wow, she's come a long way."
Yeah. Like the icing on the cake. Yeah. That's funny.
Does your dad ever call you looking for tips on the Sagamore horses?
I don't think he looks for tips anymore. I think he just bets anything that I run. I'm like, why are you betting that horse? Like, he needs to race for something. Him and my cousin have gotten very, very involved as far as trying to play the horses and stuff like that. So he might be looking for retirement money there or something. I don't know.
How good of a handicapper are you, Horatio? Do you ever dabble in it?
Not as far as handicapping. I'm honestly, Chelsea's probably a better handicapper than I am. I look too into the details of things, or look into the trainers of things and tendencies and works, and I become too overwhelmed with it. I play our horses and just mess around with things like that. Nothing too big or nothing like that. But she's definitely a better handicapper. She likes to play them pick sixes for fun and stuff like that. And still, she's a little gutsier than I am as far as, placing a bet. So it's quite funny.
Does she ever look at you after handicapping a race that one of your horses is in and say, "You know what, I don't think you have any shot today"?
I think she has questioned them. And then she'll ask me, and I'll be like, "We're all right." And then she kind of singles that horse. And if it gets, obviously I hope that it shows up. Sometimes she ends up calling me, "What do you think?" I'm like, "The horse is doing awesome." And I get home, and she's like, "Oh, look." I'm like, "What? You made that off of, like, a phone call that you made?" The decision kind of scares me a little bit sometimes what I say. So.
Well, it's funny. In all seriousness, so many trainers that have come on this program over the past several years have, talked about not really having time to sit down and handicap because they're so busy with their jobs. But they've also talked about the skill of being able to handicap or to read a condition book. And that is something that every trainer has to be good at, right?
Oh, definitely. Because placing your horses is it's just as important as feeding your horses, because you can overmatch a horse very easily if you're not careful with that.
Yeah, it's just a different form of handicapping. But you've got to know the competition that's going to go in the races, and a lot of times the jock agents can help you with that, but But really, reading a condition book is trying to handicap where your horse is going to be the favorite or have the best chance to win.
Yeah, definitely. And, you know, and sometimes I'm not too big on, you listen to the numbers, you know, you got sheets and you've got the buyers and all that kind of stuff. But sometimes, you know, they don't read true to your horse of how it feels going into a race sometimes. And sometimes you can have one that's, you know, has low buyers, but then he's just doing so good that you could take a swing at somewhere like New York or something like that, because it's just doing very well. Obviously, it's a little bit more riskier, but if you can read your horse and your horse is doing well, you can kind of take an advantage of a spot like that.
Horatio DePaz with us here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Horatio, tell us about maybe the greatest training job that you've ever done with a horse.
Greatest? I think it was just one of them. I don't know if it's the greatest or not, but it's just figuring out what the horse wanted. Like I said, we've got a filly. She's never been off the board. Actually, she's been off the board one time, but she lives out in the paddock because she just doesn't. She won't eat if you put her inside, and she's pampered a lot. Obviously, you know, she tries in the afternoons and stuff like that. But she was definitely the most challenging. You know, she's a tough gallop, she's a tough horse to train. But she's got her tendency that she just has to have in order for everything, for her to be content in what she's doing, she has to have those things accommodated to her. So just really figuring her out was, you know, the greatest thing. And for her to be able to go out and compete and do well, if I would have had her at the racetrack, we would have just completely lost her. She just wouldn't eat and she would not, you know, be very aggressive and just, you know, really whittle down to nothing. So she was, she's definitely taught me a lot, and so she would be definitely be the one that I would say that's kind of stands out to me as far as that goes.
Yeah, that's a big thing, keeping horses happy, huh?
Yeah, I think that's the biggest part of it. I mean, if you have a happy horse and he's sound, I mean, he's going to try if you put him in the correct spot. And even then, if they're happy, like, you know, you maybe can stretch them out a little bit to put them in a spot where it's just the competition is just maybe just a little bit tougher, but you might be able to get a good effort out of them. It's like people, if you have happy people working for you, they like to show up in the morning and they like to do a good job. And it reflects on your horses too, because what they do for your horses, that's how they show it in the afternoon. So it's a huge trickling effect of everything. So,
all right, Horatio, only a couple minutes left here. This hour show has really flown by. I really enjoyed the visit. But we always like to end the show by asking trainers to tell us a little something about themselves that people might not know. So we're going to play a little game. It's called Five Fast Facts to Know About Horatio DePaz, okay? And I'm going to ask you a question. Sure. You answer it very quickly, and we'll move on to the next one. So here you go. Your favorite sport other than horse racing would be?
Boxing.
Boxing. How about your favorite athlete in that sport?
Canelo.
Ooh, all right. Your favorite food, if you could have anything, would be?
Tacos.
There you go. Yeah. Favorite horse of all time?
Secretariat.
All right. And if you weren't training horses, what else would Horatio DePaz be doing?
Probably working in an oil field.
There you go. An oil worker, why not?
That's a unique set of answers. That's cool.
Yeah, very cool. Well, Horatio, listen, we appreciate the time. We want to wish you all the best moving forward over the next several months here as you continue to keep the ball rolling at Sagamore, and can't thank you enough for spending a little time with us here today.
Awesome. Thank you, guys.
All right, and don't forget that if you missed any portion of this show, you can head over to our website, horseracingradio.net. Check out the podcast of this program, all of our trainer talk shows, all of our jock talk shows. They're there for you. You can listen at your leisure. And, by the way, you can also listen to us on iTunes. Just search Horse Racing Radio Network on iTunes, and you can find us there as well.
Ad nauseum, as they say.
Some people would say. Ad nauseum, Barry Shkinoff. So many inside jokes here on the Horse Racing Radio Network.
Yes, sir. We have them.
We have had them.
We've been accused of being them ourselves.
Reel. Yeah, yeah. A bloopers reel would be wonderful for this program. Anyways, Horatio, outstanding tonight, and our thanks to him. What a great kid.
Yeah,
and yes, fantastic. He is a kid, 32.
Well, come on. Yes.
Good man. All right. Well, we want to thank Horatio for being with us. We want to thank our producer, Lee Delapina. We want to thank Sean C. for handling all of our social media. And, of course, for the Pontiff of the Pick Four, I'm Mike Penna. We will talk to you next week right here on Trainer Talk, presented by Phasic Tipton. Thanks for listening, everybody.